What we are going to do now is read a bit from the Bible together. Now, if you're sitting in one of our seats, underneath the seat you're sitting on or underneath the seat in front of you is a basket. And inside the basket is a copy of the Bible. And if you want to get a copy of the Bible, then you'll be able to read with me the passage that we're going to look at together. And it might help you to follow both what we read now and also what we're going to say about what I'm going to say about this passage later on. Some folks will have read the Bible quite a lot. Some folk might perhaps never have seen a Bible before, or at least not for a long time. But the bit we're going to read, is there. It's in Mark's Gospel, chapter 2, from verses 1 to 12. Now, Mark is in the New Testament of the Bible. Our Bibles, if you've got one, have got funny page numbers on them. They number from 1 up to about 800 or 900. That's all the Old Testament, which was written before Jesus was born. And then it goes back to number 1 again and starts numbering again. And around page 47, the second page 47, in the New Testament, you'll find Mark's Gospel. Mark was an early Christian, not one of Jesus' disciples, but probably a close friend of Peter, who was one of Jesus' 12 disciples. And therefore, probably Mark's Gospel is an account of the things that Peter said about Jesus. It's Peter's eyewitness account of some of the things that Jesus said and did and some of the things that were done to him. And we're going to read together from Mark chapter 2, which is on, it's in page 47 of the Bible I've got in front of me. It may be a page before or a page after, but it's under the heading, Jesus Heals a Paralyzed Man. And we're going to read these three or four paragraphs from verses 1 to 12. The verse numbers are indicated in the small numbers, in small text, beside the words themselves. And we'll simply read what it says. It says, a few days later, Jesus went back to Capernaum. Capernaum was a fishing town in Lake Galilee. Jesus had been there before and a few days later went back, and the news spread that he was at home. So many people came together that there was no room left, not even in front of the door. And Jesus was preaching the message to them when four men arrived carrying a paralyzed man to Jesus. Because of the crowd, however, they could not get the man to him, so they made a hole in the roof right above the place where Jesus was. And when they had made an opening, they let the man down, lying on his mat. Seeing how much faith they had, Jesus said to the paralyzed man, my son, your sins are forgiven. Now, some teachers of the law, and the teachers of the law were really the Jewish equivalent of ministers or elders or priests. They were religious leaders. The law referred to was the Old Testament, the Bible, and they were the folk whose job it was to explain the law or the scriptures to other people. And they were jealous of Jesus because more folk were coming to listen to him than had ever come to listen to them. Some teachers of the law who were sitting there thought to themselves, how does he dare to talk like this? This is blasphemy. God is the only one who can forgive sins. At once, Jesus knew what they were thinking. So he said to them, why do you think such things? Is it easier to say to this paralyzed man, your sins are forgiven, or to say, get up, pick up your mat and walk? I will prove to you, then, that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. And so he said to the paralyzed man, I tell you, get up, pick up your mat, and go home. And while they all watched, the man got up and picked up his mat and hurried away. And they were all completely amazed and praised God, saying, we have never seen anything like this. I don't know what questions you came to church with this morning, especially if you're here for the first time, maybe a regular church goer, but coming to this congregation for the first time, or maybe someone who hasn't been to church for a little while, or maybe even ever before, with a range of questions on your mind. You might have been wondering, should I come to church at all? Or how long is the sermon going to last? Or when it comes to praying, should I kneel down or stand up? When it comes to reading the Bible, will it be an old-fashioned translation with lots of these and those or something more up-to-date? Will they sing traditional hymns or modern choruses or maybe not even sing at all? Maybe your concern was the quality of the coffee at the end of the service. Well, I can reassure you about at least one of these. The coffee's good, but you may have had a whole range of questions on your mind. But I want to suggest to you this morning that there's actually only one question that really matters, and it matters more than all these. And the question is, who is Jesus? That's actually what matters. If you think that Jesus is the Son of God, well, if you don't think that he's the Son of God, it really doesn't matter what songs people use to sing his praises or what position they take up to pray to him or which version of the Bible they read about him, because it's all nonsense if Jesus is not whom he claims to be. And if you do believe that Jesus is the Son of God, if that is the answer to the question, well, then it's really of secondary importance how you do these things. What matters is how you get on with Jesus. What impact he has in your life, what impression he makes, what difference he makes. So I want us to think a little bit about that question this morning. Who is Jesus? Here's some words that were written just over 50 years ago by the Christian writer C.S. Lewis. And if you've either watched at the cinema or read at home the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and Prince Caspian and all that, C.S. Lewis is the man who wrote these stories. But he wrote other Christian books as well. And this is one of the things he wrote in his book Mere Christianity. He said, "Then comes the real shock." He was describing the Jewish people in the Old Testament. "Then comes the real shock. Among these Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes about talking as if he was God. He claims to forgive sins. He says he has always existed." Puts even Georgie into the shade in terms of his lifespan. "He says he's coming to judge the world at the end of time. He says, quite simply, the most shocking things that have ever been uttered by any human lips. But one part of that claim slips by unnoticed. I mean the claim to forgive sins. Unless the speaker really is God, that is so preposterous as to be comic. We could understand how people forgive offences against themselves. You tread on my toe, and I forgive you. You steal my money, and I forgive you. But what should we make of someone unrobbed and untrodden on who announces that you are forgiven for standing on someone else's toes or stealing someone else's money? That is exactly what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he really was the God whose laws were broken and whose love is wounded in every sin." Then he goes on to say, "A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else he is a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. And that's the end of the quote from C.S. Lewis. But that is why I say the most important question is the one in front of us this morning. Who is Jesus? And that really is the question that the passage that we read from the Bible this morning is trying to answer. The story of this paralyzed man who was healed. Now, we could read this story and perhaps try to learn a number of lessons from it. Are you awake, David? It could be a lesson about disabled rights, okay? What a terrible thing that that poor man who couldn't walk had so much trouble getting into a building that able-bodied people were able to get into without any bother at all. We could read that story and resolve among ourselves that we really ought to be better at caring for those with special needs. Or we could read the story and think about friendship. What staunch friends that man had, four willing, trusty folk who were prepared to carry him when his own strength wasn't there. We could ask ourselves, who are our friends? Who can we rely upon? And who else could we be befriending? Who could we be doing for that cannot do for themselves? Or we could think about materialism. There was this terrible act of vandalism. That's what it looked like to begin with. There must have been some truly shocked folk when the hole was made in the roof in order for the man to be lowered through it. But afterwards, when the formerly paralyzed man was walking out of the building and everyone was amazed at what had happened, I don't think anybody's mind would have been worrying about who was going to pay the bill for the joiner or the slater. We could ask ourselves, have we allowed material things to get in the way of what really matters in our lives today? We could read the story and we could learn any one of those lessons, and all of them would be good lessons to learn. And if we learnt them well, all of them would make us better people. But none of them, I don't think anyway, none of them are the point of the story. Because you see, we could have learned all of these lessons even if Jesus hadn't been in the room. But Jesus was in the room. And the story is about him. And so it is about him that we need to think. We need to ask the question, who is Jesus? So let's begin at chapter 2, verse 1, where it says that he has just come back to Capernaum. If we'd read the whole of chapter 1, you would have discovered that he had been staying there. He'd been staying with his friend Simon Peter, or with Simon Peter's mother-in-law. And when he was there, he'd started healing people, apparently miraculously. So that word spread that he was there doing these marvelous things, and a crowd began to gather. And word spread all over the whole district, and Jesus actually went to other places and began not only teaching, but performing healing miracles there. Until he became so popular that it was impossible for him to go into any town or village because he was always crowded out, and he spent his time in the countryside so that there was room for folks to come and see him. But now he's come back to Capernaum and to a full house, not even standing room only, and therefore the need for the hole in the roof. Now put yourself in the position of the folks around Jesus for a moment. He is reputed to be able to perform healing miracles. Okay? Folks getting up out their wheelchairs, blind folk seeing, sick folk recovering. What would your reaction to that be? If you had heard about it, most of us would probably think, not sure if that's really true. Maybe the folks who are telling me the story are exaggerating a wee bit or couldn't see properly. And even if we were eyewitnesses ourselves, we saw the man leap up out of his wheelchair, if they had such things as wheelchairs in those days, we might wonder whether he was really wheelchair bound to begin with. So there might be a degree of skepticism about. But not among everyone, because when Jesus saw these four friends bring the paralyzed man to the house where he was teaching, it says in verse 5, he saw how much faith they had. They weren't among the skeptics or the doubters. And you would think he would want to reward them for their faith by doing what they wanted, so that when the paralyzed man was lowered on his mat, the very first thing Jesus would want to reward their faith by doing was by making him unparalyzed, by making him able-bodied again. And yet instead he turns to the paralyzed man and says, "My son, your sins are forgiven." So that's maybe the first thing we learn about Jesus, that he does for us, certainly other than we expect. He doesn't always do what we think he's going to do. And in a sense, that really makes sense. If he is the Son of God, well, he's not a tame God. He's not at our beck and call. He's not under our control. Jesus is not like this 21st century phenomenon that many of us will be aware of. He's not a God like Google. You know what Google is? The internet search engine that will answer any question that you ask. Type into Google, "What is the distance from the earth to the sun?" and it will tell you. Type into Google, "What is the best value car insurance policy I can get?" and it will tell you. "How many garlic cloves should I put in the stew I'm cooking tonight?" it will answer the question. "What was the result of last night's semi-final in the Australian Tiddlywink Cup?" Google will tell you the answer to any question that you ask it. But what it will not do is this. If you type into Google, "How far is the distance from the earth to the sun?" Google will not come back and say, "Never mind that for the moment. You'd better renew your car insurance policy because it's almost out of date." Or, "How many cloves should I put in the garlic tonight?" It will not come back and say, "Never mind the cloves and the garlic. Your friend's in trouble. You need to go and visit him." Google will not do that for you. Google is our servant. It does what we ask. Jesus presents himself here as the master who tells us what we need. So with great faith, he says to the man in front of him and those who brought him, "You come to me for healing, but I want to provide you with forgiveness." I wonder if there's people here who sometimes feel that God lets them down by not doing what we want. But what kind of God would it be who always did what we want, who was at our beck and call? Who is Jesus? Well, if he really is the Son of God, we should expect him not to do what we expect. That's the first thing. But then Jesus goes on to show that he's not just a man of words, but also a man of action. Let me illustrate like this. Suppose you came to me one day in great distress, crying your eyes out, saying, "I've got real trouble because I'm in debt to the tune of £1 million. And my creditors are coming to get me. They're going to throw me out my house and home and take the clothes off my back and bankrupt me and impoverish me. And I'm in this terrible situation." I might come up and put my arm around and say, there. "Don't you worry about that. I can see exactly what your problem is. You just need £1 million. I know what you need. Tell you what, here's my checkbook. I will write, 'Pay the bearer £1 million. Give you the check." Well, you might go out leaping and dancing with all the joy that the lame man had at the end of the story today, until you met one of my friends who would tell you, "I'm very sorry, but he doesn't have £1 million in the bank. He might have promised to help you. He might have known what was needed, but the check that he's written is not worth anything." Well, that's what Jesus' enemies are saying in the passage that we read, these teachers of the law who pour scorn on his suggestion. He can talk about forgiveness, they think to themselves, but he cannot deliver, because God is the only one who can forgive sins. And to that extent, they were absolutely right. As C.S. Lewis says, "The one who can forgive sins is the one whose laws were broken, whose love is wounded. He is the one who must forgive." But what the teachers of the law have done here is played into Jesus' hands. They have set him up with an opportunity. Effectively, they have said to him, "If you prove that you are as good as your word, then we will admit that you are the Son of God. Because only God can forgive sins, and that's what you have promised to do." And so Jesus proves that he is as good as his word, that he is a man of action as well as words. He tells the paralyzed man to walk, and his words make it happen. And so, having told the paralyzed man that his sins are forgiven, his words also have made it happen. Who is Jesus? He's not just someone who can diagnose our problems and then offer us advice or comfort. He is empowered to make changes. And as we already saw, doesn't restrict that power to our expectations. So perhaps I hope that he will make me richer, but Jesus will make me less greedy. Or I hope that he will help me to triumph over my enemies, and Jesus will teach me to love them. Or he will not satisfy my demands, but make me a more patient person. Or not remove all the irritating people from my life, but rather show me how to get on with them better and how to make them beautiful. Not to take away my sickness, perhaps, but to take away my fear of dying. Jesus is a man of action as well as words. And finally, this Jesus really says here, I'm a man who is on a winning streak. I will prove to you in verse 10 that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins. Why the Son of Man? Why does he not say, I will prove to you that I have authority to forgive sins, or even that the Son of God has authority to forgive sins? Why the Son of Man? Well, at its most basic level, that phrase, the Son of Man, simply means a human being. I am a son of man, and of a woman as well, my mother and father, and most of you, I imagine, maybe even all of you, are children of a woman and a man. So at one level, Jesus is simply acknowledging here the difficulty of being forgiven in a godlike way by someone who is merely a human being. But there is more than that going on here, something that the teachers of the law would have understood, because this title, Son of Man, meant a little more. Because way back in their history, some centuries earlier, the prophet Daniel, you know Daniel in the lion's den? Well, after Daniel came out of the lion's den, he had a vision or a dream. And in the dream, he saw four horrible beasts, too awful for words, doing things to the people of God that were indescribably terrible. And Daniel, quite rightly, was scared by the dream. And even more scared when an angel appeared to him in his vision and interpreted it, explaining to him that each of these beasts or monsters represented evil empires who were going to come and attack and persecute the people of God. So Daniel was on the verge of a dreamlike panic when the next stage of his dream happened and someone came to rescue the people of God from these beasts or monsters. And this is how Daniel described what he saw. In the book of the prophet Daniel, in chapter 7, verse 13, he says, I saw what looked like a human being. Well, they didn't use those words. I saw what looked like a son of man. And he was given authority and honor and royal power so that people of all nations and races and languages would serve him, and his authority would last forever and his kingdom would never end. So when Jesus said, I will show you that I, as the Son of Man, have the authority to forgive sins, he is claiming that title. He is claiming to be the man whom Daniel saw in his dream, who would come with all power and glory and honor to bring the final and lasting solution to the problem of persecution and suffering for the people of God. The one whom God would send to rescue his people. Ordinary looking, but extraordinarily powerful. And not just come to make a few things better, but to put everything right. Darkness defeated. Eden restored. Rolling back all the influence of evil, so that those like the man who had been lowered through the roof in front of him would not just have their paralysis undone, but would also have their sins completely forgiven and everything the way it should have been. So if you went to Jesus and asked, which is worse, for this man to be paralyzed or unforgiven? I think Jesus would have answered, the worst possible thing is for that man not to know who I am and not to believe what only I can do. And as we come to the end of the story, we see that no one was left in any doubt about what Jesus could do. Do you see that in verse 12? The story finishes with these words, that they were all completely amazed and praised God, saying, we've never seen anything like this. No skeptics left. Nobody left in the dark. And that should really have ended all the opposition to Jesus for the whole of the rest of his life on earth. And certainly, there should never again have been a teacher of the law who disbelieved in him. But though they had been left no room for doubt, the fact is that they did soon begin to question again. And over the rest of Mark's gospel, if you read it, you will see that the questions become more hostile, and the doubts become hardened opposition, and the charge of blasphemy, which first occurs here in chapter 2, verse 7, becomes the charge of which he was convicted and for which he was crucified. In a way that is totally irrational, and yet by people who were utterly convinced. And I just want to leave you with this question this morning by asking if there's anyone here today in that position who, for no good reason, is totally convinced that Jesus is not the Son of God. The only question that really matters, who is he? And I believe the only answer that makes any sense, he is whom he claims to be. He really is the Son of God. I shouldn't expect him to do what I expect or to approve of everything I want or to leave me alone if I don't want anything to do with him. But I can expect him to invite me to trust him to do what he wants, and now to begin that lasting transformation of me that will result in all the causes and effects of sin being rolled away forever, until in the end I as little resemble my present self as the healed man did after his former paralysis had been taken away. And he disappeared out the door of the room with his mat in his hands, his sin left behind, and his faith in Jesus justified. Who is Jesus? You must make your choice. He was and is the Son of God, or a madman, or something worse. Shut him up for a fool, spit at him and kill him as a demon, or fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. I hope and I pray that God will use our reading of the Bible today and our thoughts and our words to bless us as we go our separate ways.